good evening, everyone. Again, I trust everyone is enjoying the dinner as well as the conversation. I trust everyone is enjoying your dinner and a good conversation all round. Now we have come to the highlight of tonight's event. So apart from the Distinguished Fellowship, the first highlight, the second highlight is this one, which is a dialogue with our senior minister. Now, I'm mindful of time, so I'm going to set the format. In the format, I'll explain to you, is that I will be carrying on the dialogue. I will be asking a series of questions to senior minister. And these questions are basically centered around three broad areas which I have in mind, and that is on geopolitical things. And then the second issue is on climate change. As you know, I am an environmental economist, and so I will be interested to ask questions on the environment. And the third one has to do, I think everyone will be interested, which is domestic issues. So we start out with the external environment, and then move on finally with the Singapore local environment. Okay. Now, after the dialogue, when I finish conversing, I will then open it to the floor for a few of you to ask questions. Again, I'm mindful of time, so please, we all keep our questions short and targeted, all right? So let's begin. Senior Minister, again, thank you very much for spending time with us and coming to this event. And I want to start off with the first question, which is, as you know, you look at the Liberation Day of Trump, mainly the terrorists, right? That was actually in April this year. And we have seen major shifts and departures from what we are used to see as past norms. So as an economist, we like to ask the question, is comparative advantage dead in view of all the trade protectionism and so on? And how does that impact international growth? Please.
Well, first of all, Houston, thank you very much for inviting me and also for honoring me with a Distinguished Fellow Award. You have now given me a high reputation to live up to. I shall try my best. On Liberation Day and international trade, I don't think comparative advantage is dead. America has decided that they want to take a more narrow, bilateral, transactional view of international trade. Other countries still have a framework of the WTO, imperfect in many ways, but enabling quite extensive and quite free trade amongst them. And I think many countries want to preserve as much of that as possible. We will have to see whether that's possible, because when you have one of the biggest economies in the world taking a radically different approach and really not just withdrawing from, but expressing its disapproval of the WTO system, that will have repercussions, and we will have to see how the eventual situation shakes out. But one thing I have learned in government is that you can fail to follow an economic principle, but you cannot repeal an economic law. Whether you follow it or not, the economic law exists. That's just the way the world works. That's just the way human societies work. And if you don't follow it, well, you may have your reasons, and you want to override it and do something different. But market forces, incentives for people to act in certain ways in their own interest, for countries to act in their own interest, are very powerful and very difficult to just chop off. You close here, it pops up somewhere else. You close there, it pops up somewhere else again. You think you've achieved an objective, something else happens and you're chasing your tail. So I think that we are certainly, from an economic point of view, worse off now than before the 2nd of April, globally. But it's yet to be seen how things will turn out.
So I'm glad you mentioned that. Well, you said that comparative advantage is still on, but it is evolving. I think it's evolving. And what do you think what is the new framework on the global economy, and what can we do in Singapore too?
I suppose the best framework is the world temporarily minus one. Meaning the framework mostly remains. America, it still has to do business with the world. You still need rare earths. You still need all sorts of things from the rest, from the other countries. But, well, for the time being, you wish the rules were different and you're trying your best to change it. Temporarily, meaning maybe at some point they can come back and participate again in a more open and constructive way. But that's the best possible scenario. It may or may not happen. Meanwhile, what can countries do? Well, you can make friends with like-minded partners within a region like ASEAN, within a broader area like the Regional Economic, RCEP, Regional Comprehensive Economic Partnership, or with economies which complement each other and have a broader range like the CPTPP. And I think we can also work together on the WTO framework, like-minded countries, how to make the WTO work without being paralyzed by consensus gridlock, which has been one of the big problems, whether or not the Americans are part of the party. And to be able to participate and have enough of a consensus of countries to say we move ahead. Not everybody is along, and some countries are not comfortable. Well, that's all right. The rest of us, let's move ahead. And we've got some progress on that in a few modest areas, and I hope that more of that can be done. We should try and make the multilateral framework less bad rather than write it off.
I think however much we like economic principles to apply and how much we worship economics, actually, but we are limited by geopolitical constraints, as always. So these are a reminder to us that we have to work within the political constraints as well, not just focusing on economic efficiency. But this suggests that we need a lot of diversification, all right, in terms of diversifying out of our reliance to the usual sources like for the US and so on. There are lots of markets which are unexplored at this point in time, and I think this gives us an opportunity to look at all these markets.
We should do that. You should diversify within the region. You should diversify to fresh markets. Latin America, we have talked about, hasn't gone very far with us yet. The African continent is a very diverse continent. It's 50-plus countries, but some of them are promising. And we should explore all these new opportunities.
Precisely. So anyway, I mean, this impact of tariffs, could it be temporary, meaning that as long as Trump is in office, when he goes out...
No, I do not believe that. I do not believe that. It will not remain like this, but it will not go back to the status quo ante. In trade policy, in economic policy, once you make a move, you can't take it back. There are consequences. When you first put in the tariffs, everybody complains. The people who need steel say, why is the steel so expensive? The people who need chips, who make chips, say, why can't I sell to China? Why can't I import my chips from Taiwan? Whatever. But once you have put in the tariffs, and once new players come who depend on the tariffs and need the tariff protection, and you say, I'm taking the tariffs away, we're going back to where we were, it's politically not possible. And all politically not possible because the businesses with vested interests will complain. Politically not possible because then you'll be attacked and say, you know, your predecessor did this to protect us. Why are you unilaterally giving away a chip? You must bargain for something, which is what happened when Biden took over from Trump number one. Trump one put in tariffs against China. Biden didn't take them away. In fact, he tightened the screws on China more. And when there was a debate between Trump and Kamala Harris last year during the campaign, Kamala says, you know, if Trump comes in so many tariffs, then God, the world will turn upside down. And Trump's answer was, Well, in my first term, I put on tariffs on China. It's now 3.5 years into Biden. The tariffs are still there. How's that? There was no answer.
Well, anyways, I think Singapore is not so badly affected yet.
Well, I the Chinese have a saying, 五十步笑百步. The person who retreated 50 steps from the battle laughs at the person who retreated 100 steps, and you're worse off than me. But actually, we have a free trade agreement with the U.S. It's a zero. We have imports from the U.S., 0% tariff. Now the U.S. has decided that Singapore has 10% tariffs, like everybody else, and we console ourselves that that's the best rate, and we hope that we stay there. I suppose if you treat the world as the way it is and ask, could it be worse? It could be worse. But is it better than we were before? I am more skeptical.
Okay. All right. I think there's a lot to be said on tariffs and so on. I want to move on to another related concept to the external environment, which is the subject of global warming. Global warming and climate change has always challenged us meaning mankind. And in fact, right now, it is even worse because we have all this deglobalization, trade, all this protectionism, you know, non-global cooperation, where we need global cooperation for something as widely and broadly, and the whole world must be involved, but we are not having it, so we are retreating. So a few countries have managed to get together and they say, let's try to do something. But I don't think that's enough. Do you agree?
Well, first of all, global warming is an inherently very difficult problem to solve. If you just look at it from an economic perspective, you would call it a global commons problem, meaning it's a resource which we all share, which we all benefit from, but which we are not personally paying for. And you therefore need to solve it by coming together in order to do it collectively. But when you do it collectively, there's always the risk of somebody opting out and saying, sorry, you carry on, I will just free ride on your hard work and your sacrifices and your belt tightening. And that's called a free rider problem. And whether or not one big country opts out from the Paris Agreement, we have the risk of a free rider problem. What do we do about it? Well, in principle, even if one country opts out, the other countries should do the sensible things. And there are some studies which show that China is big enough, even without counting benefits to the rest of the world, just costs and benefits to themselves, they should cut emissions in order to reduce the impact on themselves. What more if it is possible for China, maybe India, maybe EU, maybe Brazil? This is a dream package. But in principle, what more if other countries can come together, like-minded, agree amongst themselves on rules which will reduce their emissions, whether they do a carbon tax or whatever rule, and then have some mechanism to deal with free riders, such as border adjustment tariffs, I think they call it. So that, well, amongst ourselves, we abide by rules. If you're selling into me and you didn't cost your carbon when you want to come into my market, I will tax you. And that way, hopefully, you'll reduce a free rider problem and you can get a bit further. So economically, you can get maybe 3/4 of a solution. But politically, it's very hard because then the other countries will say, look at that fellow, he is free riding on us. And I can't quite levy enough price on him. Why should I tighten my belt? In fact, some Southeast Asian countries have already said that. If America is going to be like this, I have to reconsider my commitments. In fact, Singapore has to take a practical view of it, and we have made commitments to go to net zero by 2050 and to go to, I think, half our emissions by a certain date before that. And we have had to say, we are doing this on condition everybody else is playing ball. But if other people are not playing ball, then it does not make sense for us to stop breathing in order not to generate CO2. Because even if we did that in Singapore, It won't save the world.
That's right. Actually, SM, you're very right. And not many people appreciate this, that Singapore actually is quite exemplary in our contribution to the, you know, the global cause. We are contributing only 0.11% of the carbon emissions. So even if we stop everything, it makes not much impact, you know. But yet we are doing it. And we have put in the right measures, I think, with adaptation and so on.
We are trying to be a good global citizen.
Yes.
Do our part so that we are in good standing. We are not free riding on other people.
Yes.
And we should try and do it in a rational way. We have put in a carbon tax. It's going up. I think it's going to about $50 by 2030. It is going to be a cost on the economy. It may cause some businesses to have to reconsider their plans if they're not able to abate their emissions. But if we are serious about wanting to peak before 2030 and to decline progressively after that, then there's really no alternative to some businesses, to many businesses really emitting less, or some businesses deciding, I can't emit less, well, I have to reconsider my plans altogether. There's no way out. If everybody can do it without pain, then you probably haven't done very much.
You know, the other thing, SM, is that we have recently discovered geothermal energy source. And this time, it's possibly deep enough and with the right temperature. So it might be a game changer.
Well, I hope so. But our electricity consumption is about, or electric production is about 10 gigawatts. And if we are lucky, if we work very hard, you can get 50 megawatts out of the ground. So it's helpful, but I think we need to work harder.
Okay, I mean, these are really tough issues for us. But let's move on to, I think, a topic which will, I think, probably everyone is eagerly waiting for SM at least to discuss some of these local issues, domestic issues. So we have a room full of economists. Well, most are economists, studied economics, career in economics, applying economics. No? So, SM, do you think understanding economics by government officials, and also by people in general is very important for the country?
Yes, of course.
So we got SM to say confirmation. Economics is very important.
Yes, of course. Not just because I'm here, but that is the reason I'm here. It is not the only perspective on the world, but if you don't understand that, you're going to have a lot of misunderstandings which are going to cause you a lot of problems. Mm-hmm. In the government, many of the ministries must understand the economic forces at work and consequences of what they are doing. It's not just MTI and MOF, but MSE, looking after climate and water supplies. MOM, looking after manpower. MND, looking after land planning, housing. Ministry of Health. All of the ministries actually ought to have inside them somewhere in their thinking inner core, an element of economic input so that they can understand the economic forces at work, what are the incentives they have to deal with, what are the externalities of their policies, how they can use market forces and harness these incentives rather than disregarding the market forces and say, you just stop doing that and think that that solves the problem. So amongst the government, you need that. Amongst the population, you also need that, because then when the government imposes a policy or implements a policy, people can understand what it is about, and you may not like it, but at least you have some feel for the explanation, and you accept that, okay, that cannot be helped. One of the things we have to explain, for example, is, why is water so expensive in Singapore? And the economist's answer is, because we are pricing water to its marginal production price, not the average price. You take water from the reservoir built 100 years ago is cheap, But you take one extra liter, the reservoir has run out of capacity. I must produce one extra liter. I must build a new reservoir. I may need to make new water. I may need to make desalination. It cost me $2 per cubic meter. I have to price that. The marginal, incremental unit price. And everybody should pay that, even for your first cubic meter. So the economists understand that. The public, not so much. And so we have these debates, not just with the public, but even in Parliament. And we have to explain this. And we also have to do things which help people to accept the policy beyond just swallowing the explanation. For example, we have USAFE. We did this. I did USAFE when in 1997 or thereabouts, we made a radical price revision to water. It was 50 cents per cubic meter. And over a period of 2 or 3 years, I pushed it to $1.50. Because it had to reflect scarcity, and at that time, there was some questions being raised about the security of our water imports. Quite fierce statements were being made. And so people understood we needed to do it, but to soften it, ease it in, we said, okay, you save. You pay for the water, but I give you a grant every month, you save X dollars for those who need it. I think middle income and below, thereabouts. So many dollars. You need the water, this helps you to pay for it. You don't need the water, just keep it, it's for you. So I don't distort your incentive. I have not made the water cheap. Water is expensive, but you are okay. Now, that's quite a complicated argument. But tonight is the economic society, so I'm trying it on you.
That's why you see SM, you know, understanding economics is so important from basic principles of trade-offs, opportunity costs, incentives, and now we just mentioned marginalism.
If we had not done this, we could not have had done new water.
Yes.
Or desalination, because actually that is what it is costing us to make the additional supplies, and if people are not paying that amount for what they are consuming, those projects would not have been economic.
Precisely. Anyway, Sam, I want to pick up on the earlier point when you mentioned market principles. I mean, if we look at government policies, decisions over the past decades and so on, much has relied on, guided by the best of market principles. And we teach that to our students as well, you know, the beauty of the market. But there are instances where you need state intervention, where market outcomes may not coincide with social objectives. So can you elucidate, at least tell us some of the examples where you think that the market sort of fell short and you need intervention?
Well, big ones, health, education, housing, where we have intervened in massive ways, and yet we have tried to continue to use market forces in order not to completely remove the incentives for efficiency and for doing better. Healthcare, for example, if you have a state system like a National Health Service, you run into very serious difficulties. The British spend a lot of money on national health and they are not very happy with the results. If you leave it completely to the private sector, which nobody quite does, but the Americans do it quite a lot, the market doesn't work very well. Health economics is a massive subject, and health normal markets fail in so many ways that you end up paying a lot of money and not getting good health care. So somewhere, not just in between the two, somehow you have to structure a system with enough state intervention to prevent the private sector from running off on its own, and yet enough costing and pricing in order to encourage efficient running of our hospitals and clinics, and at the same time, the users, the patients, the population, not overusing the healthcare because it's free at point of use. And I think that we have a balance which works not badly now, although this is a continuing challenge because healthcare costs, technology and costs keep on moving year by year. And from time to time, we have problems, for example, with our IP plans right now, which is, to a very large extent, free at point of use, and that is causing market failure. So it's not that insurance companies are profiteering at you. It's that you make a system, the costs get out of control, you raise the prices, costs rise further, everybody is unhappy. And taking it away also makes people not so happy because they've already paid and I may get sick tomorrow. And yet you have to do something about it. But when you invite the health minister, he can tell you more.
I think I said, let's pick a little bit more about something related to it on markets and so on. Let's talk about the COE. I mean, there have been a lot of calls from what I hear that there are deserving cases why some category of people who apply for car ownership to be treated more kindly, to have less, to pay less for the COE, such as families. So what do you think? Should we have
there are many good arguments like that. That is the trouble. There are so many good arguments like that that it becomes very difficult for the government to design a system which takes into account how many kids you have, how young they are, whether you've got somebody disabled in the family, whether you have an old folk, whether your job requires you to go place to place delivering supplies or meeting customers, or whether you are driving to a place at work very far away, no bus, I need a car. I think if you want to design a scheme which worries about all those things, it will fail. So let me just give you a bit of perspective and explain to you where we stand. What is it this is about? It's about allocation of a scarce resource trying to use economic principles. Okay? Allocating a scarce resource using economic principles. What is a scarce resource? In the first instance, road space, using the roads. But the COE is a proxy for the road space. So we are also rationing the COE, certain numbers, and then you have to allocate them. How do you allocate them? And the answer is, we would like to distribute them in a fair, efficient way. And that means I set a price, people come to buy it, and then those who bought it get full value. Those who didn't buy it don't feel that they missed out on a windfall. What does that mean? I must price it fair market value. Fair market value. Which is also, economists will say, the market clearing price. Okay? I put the price, people come to buy. Turns out I've got 100 COEs, 100 buyers, just nice. If I've got 100 COEs, 101 buyers, I put up the price a little bit. 99 buyers, I bring down the price a little bit. How do I do that? Well, I need a price discovery mechanism. Now, those of you in the finance business will know what is price discovery. When companies issue shares or bonds, you go around, you make the market, you make an estimate. Well, that's where the market roughly is. What is our price discovery mechanism? It is the COE tender system. And every 2 weeks, you can read it, just like you read the 4D results in the newspapers every weekend. Sometimes it goes up, sometimes it goes down. When it goes up a bit more than people would like to see, you get many requests to say, how about we change the system and make it not go up so much? But, and one of the things which they say is, how about pay as you bid? Because right now, you just submit a bid and then everybody pays just the lowest successful bid. So maybe people are being reckless. But actually, if you look at how we are making our COE tenders work now, in fact, we are almost pay as you bid. Why do I say that? Because previously, when we started off, you name your number, you seal your envelope, you submit your envelope, it's a tender, it's closed, After the tender close, after the time closes, you open all the envelopes and you decide what the outcome is. But now, because it's online, even as people are submitting their bids, we show you what the price is at that moment, clearing price, moment by moment until the bid closes. So if you go, I haven't done this, but if you go, I've seen the charts. Normally, it's open for 10 days or something. The price is about zero because most people haven't bid it yet until about half an hour before the tender closes. Then the real money comes in. It comes up, it price rises, and everybody can see where everybody else is. And by about 5 to 10 minutes before the bids close, more or less everybody has put their bids in. So actually, everybody has bid more or less according to what he wants. So actually, it's pay as you bid. So in fact, what people don't understand is that we have a system, it works quite well. You would like the outcome to be cheaper, but as long as I'm going on allocating COEs a certain number, there's a certain market clearing price. For that number, there's only that market clearing price. If you want the price to be lower, then you must put out more COEs, which is what the government is now doing. We took from the future. We are putting up 5-10% more, and therefore the supply is higher, and I hope that the price will be a bit more moderated. But there's really no easy way to make something which is valuable be distributed fairly and at the same time very cheap. Other cities sometimes give up trying to do that, and they've decided it's politically too difficult. They practically say, I've set a nominal price, anybody can apply, and it becomes a raffle, meaning we all apply, no harm, I may win, in which case I get something. Beijing used to do that for some time. But I don't think that's the right solution for Singapore.
I think to add on to that is that the appeal to get lower COEs for special categories. So where does it stop? Because there's so many categories that you can think of.
Well, I think there are two more direct answers to that. One, I can guarantee every Singaporean affordable, convenient transportation. Yes. I cannot guarantee every Singaporean affordable car. It's different from houses. Okay, HDB houses. Every Singaporean can get one, maybe 3-room, maybe 5-room, maybe 2-room. But every Singaporean household can get one. But cars, no. Transportation, yes. That's number one. Number two, if in fact you have a special need, for example, you have a kid, it's better rather than I give you a cheaper COE, I give you a bigger baby bonus, and you want, you can use that to buy a baby seat or help to pay for a little bit of a car. And directly help the group you need to help in cash rather than make complicated schemes which then end up with all kinds of contradictions and wrong incentives.
SM, let's change topic from transport cars to maybe the cost of doing business. Rental rates. People have been hearing that SMEs, they're asking for help in the rental rates market. Should the government intervene?
Well, I think we have to watch the market. We have to watch whether it's competitive, whether there's collusive cartel behavior. And if there is, then we have to intervene to break that up. But generally speaking, rentals in Singapore, they are not low because I think Singapore is a small place and there's a limited supply. And if you go across a causeway or across the Singapore Straits, of course, it's much cheaper. But the rentals adjust to the market. Not as fast as we would like because they have a period. You sign a lease, it's 2 years or 3 years. And sometimes when the market comes down, the landlord prefers to give you a private discount rather than tell everybody the rents have gone down. So that has to be taken into account. But I think generally the market works reasonably well. Some cities have tried rent control. It doesn't work. The result is even fewer units, even fewer landlords, maintenance goes down, everybody is affected. Who benefits? The person who happens to be there when the rent control was put in place for some time. After that, well, we're all in a worse position.
Yes, that's very true. Now, I'm mindful of time, so I need to reserve some time for the floor to ask questions. So, but I think this is a very interesting your discussion on the constraints of the markets. Even though the markets can produce wonderful outcomes, it is constrained by certain things, and governments need to fulfill certain social objectives. So that's the point. I think we just have enough time for a few questions. Otherwise, we will go on and continue on to talk about more and more things. Let me have a show of hands. I would like to maybe put two or three questions together. Please state your name, your affiliation, and keep the questions targeted. No long comments, please. So I have one question here. The lady, and then someone at the back. So can you just ask a question? Then followed by the lady and the one at the back. Maybe you can take three questions at a go. Yes, please. Mike. Can we pass the mic to...
Hi. Hello. Dr. Pua Kai Hong from Lee Kuan Yew School. Can I just ask this question? 25 years ago, you actually mentioned at the National Day speech that we'll kick the can down the road, you know. That's because of healthcare. And healthcare has a big problem now in here in Singapore with the aging of the population and so on. And what's your comment about the distribution of healthcare of 80% to 20% now is going to 90% public healthcare because of the problems in the private healthcare right now?
Okay, so one is on healthcare costs and so on. This gentleman, Professor, Dr. Prakash in front.
Sure. Thanks very much, SM, for those remarks. I think listening to you, some characteristics of, in a way, the part of the success of the Singapore story, which is policymakers are able to think long term, to kind of take risks, to go against the grain. The question I have is, what are the risks that you see of these traits changing? That we become a little bit more short term, a little bit more risk averse, moving away from marginal pricing to average pricing. What are the risks of that scenario playing out, and how can we ensure that doesn't happen?
Thank you. So the question, one on health, one on risk, changing risk, the lady. Yeah, the one you're raising your hand now, this lady, yes. The mic. Please state your affiliation.
Hi, my name is Violetta from GIC. Thank you, Senior Minister. I would like to ask about generative AI. I was wondering, what are your thoughts on what the key skills are for the future generations of Singaporeans in the light of this transformative technology in order to kind of stay competitive and resilient in the many decades to come? Thank you.
Do you want to take three or one?
Yeah, I'll take them.
Okay, so SM wants all the
three. Okay, first question on healthcare. I don't remember saying that we should kick any cans down the road. Maybe I misheard you. But if we kick cans down the road, usually we meet them later on and they become more difficult to handle. And in Singapore, we don't like to do that, because in Singapore, it's quite likely that the person meeting the can down the road will be the same as the person who did the kicking some time ago. And So that's one of the reasons why we raised the GST rate over the last couple of years from 7 to 9%, so as to address healthcare costs rising up. The public-private share of healthcare, whether it should be 80-20, 90-10, you can argue where it needs to be, but I think there's a role for private healthcare in Singapore. And as the minister has said, you also would like to have different models of private healthcare, and we would like to see if we can help to make that happen. That's a kind of influencing the market without intervening, but we will see if we can find some way to help to make that happen. Prakash asked about the risk of leaders becoming short-term and not taking the economic rational approach and just looking for short-term political dividends. That, honestly, is always there. Because most of the time, in most circumstances, it's easier to be a leader who oversimplifies issues and say, I have a good solution. Follow me. This is the way. And after 2 days, everything will be solved. Rather than somebody who gives you a long exposition more suited to the economic society. So it's very hard. And what you need is somebody who internally understands what the economic society thinks, but publicly is able to express it in terms which are maybe stripped down, maybe simplified, maybe you present it in an analogy, but sufficient for people to accept and to have really is animal faith in the leader and the leadership team. So I believe you, not because I understand all the ins and outs of what is a marginal incremental cost as opposed to average cost, but because you have shown results and I trust you. And therefore, I give you the benefit of the doubt and I will go along. And I think you have my interest at heart. I would like everybody to learn some economics. I would like everybody to also see it from the perspective of the government looking at the economic problem, which is not the same as an individual looking at the same problem. But really, to have good leadership, you need to have that trust and to be able to have that political that political debate in the public arena, which is anchored on logic, on realities, on what the evidence shows, as opposed to being based on what is politically expedient. And I speak my book. If I'm in the opposition, I try to, you know, propound something which sounds nicer than what the government is prepared to offer. And if I'm in the government, I try to do things which are nicer than what the country really needs. And there is no certainty that Singapore can do that forever. So we just have to know that and therefore conclude, let's try our best to make it last as long as we can. Third, what are the generative AI skills needed? I do not know for sure. The technology is moving very fast. Some people say it's going to shoot through the roof. It's already quite good for good number of applications. If you are doing medical diagnosis, it's very respectable. If you are doing image processing, it's very good. If you are passing law exams, it's also respectable. But whether that goes to AGI, what do they call it? Automatic General Intelligence. The jury is still out. It may be you carry on in this way and just add more CPUs and processing power and data, you can get there. But it may be that you need further insights and breakthroughs in order to go beyond just what the current statistical models are able to produce. So we can't say, but that what you have already in some professions is already making a big difference, I think that is a fact. And we should, in Singapore, do our best to understand it and how we can use it. Even if I'm not at the leading edge generating the next DeepSeek, I should be able to make use of DeepSeek and other things in order to do our jobs better, deliver services better, be more efficient, be more productive. And I think that is within Singaporeans' capabilities, and we can train Singaporeans to be able to adapt to this and to be able to move either to do their job better using the new tools, or in some cases, if those jobs are no longer there, you're really moving up to do a different job or moving to another industry to do a different job. And that will need a lot of government support. That's one area where to say I leave it to the market or I leave it to laissez-faire, I don't think it's going to work. We need government resources, encouragement, exhortation. Leadership by example, it makes a big difference. But one day you will have an AI bot here answering questions during your dinner. So far, I think I still have a job.
I think I'm mindful for time, so I don't want to press on, except I think we have a young professionals wing somewhere, and I would wish they would ask a question. Do you have any pressing question for SM?
Somebody right at the end.
Where's the young professionals? Raise your hand.
They are right at the end.
Oh, okay, you're right. Do you have a question?
Yeah, but we can't hear him.
He's going to use the mic. Is your mic working? Okay, just change the mic then.
SM Lee, thank you for sharing. My name is Benjamin Lau. I'm the chairman of the ESS Young Professionals Wing, and I'm honored to ask a question on behalf of the Youth Wing. So for many young Singaporeans today, the definition of success is shifting. You know, when I grew up, I've been hearing about earning money, home ownership, and climbing the career ladder. But increasingly, some of us care more about purpose, sustainability, mental health, and making a difference. And this is in addition to earning a lot of money and starting a family. You know? So my question is, how should young Singaporeans define success in today's society? And what mindset should we adopt for the future of Singapore? Thank you.
I think it's for the young Singaporeans to define what they would like success to mean. If you are born with all the advantages which your parents' generation didn't have. I mean, if you are 35 years old, 35 years ago was, well, the internet existed, but social media didn't. AI certainly had not made the breakthroughs yet. And it was a completely different world. The cadence was different. In 35 years, our standard of living has gone up in Singapore, probably, I would say, 50, 70%, or at least 50%. Your opportunities for education have gone up from maybe 30% of people going to university, now nearly half the cohort going to university. They come out, there are jobs available for them. And the world's their oyster. You have a Singapore degree from an AU, you can go anywhere in the world and find work. We are in Silicon Valley, we are all over China. You go to deepest Africa, you'll find Singaporeans there. In Rwanda, there's one young lady who's running an advanced chicken farm. No, doing very well. So, what do you want to make of your life? For yourself, for your family, for your country, for your fellow human beings. There are so many things you can do. Don't lie flat. It is such a waste that your parents will be disappointed in you is neither here nor there. You ought to be, if you lie flat, after a while, I hope you're ashamed of yourself. But we did all this for you. Make use of it. And show us that actually you're better than us.
Thank you. So, don't you think that economics is such an exciting discipline? Even our current prime minister is an economist, right? So, I mean, like the youth wing, I would say that you should live, breathe, and think everything economics. So with that, I think let us all thank SM Lee for spending time with us in this dialogue. Thank you, everyone.